5. Entering into reality as a whole. This conception of culture and ecumenism requires a totally new approach to education. Christian formation has the aim of educating the human person in all his dimensions. Christian companionship, understood as the dwelling place of the human, encourages the person persuasively, pedagogically, and systematically to compare himself with reality up to its furthest frontiers, reawakening and sustaining the set of questions and original points of evidence that constitute our heart. This teaches us to sift everything and keep what is good. In other words, it educates us. What does it mean to educate? To educate means to help the human soul to enter into reality as a whole. There is a starting point that makes this definition more understandable. Reason is awareness of reality, as it emerges from experience, according to the totality of its factors. Without this totality, we could not speak of rationality. If reason becomes a definition of reality while neglecting totality, then it is presumption, pretension, the inappropriate dilation of the sphere of knowledge, reduction, constriction, a premise for obstructing freedom. Taking in reality as a whole. This is why man must always feel, sincerely and humbly, that he is searching. The more lively and humble this quest, the more intelligent its outcome will be, since man will involve in his engagement, in his effort, all that he finds positive and agreeable. Someone who deceives himself into thinking that he has already found everything and has nothing new to discover risks discarding along his way the very encounters that can be the most meaningful. For this reason, someone who already knows that his own religion is enough will never meet Jesus Christ. Even if Christ were to knock on his door, sit down at his table, and speak for 2 or 3 hours, as he did with John and Andrew, he will never understand. To educate someone is to help him to understand the factors of reality as they go on multiplying till they become a whole that will always remain the true endpoint of his action. You do not need to be Leopardi with his hymn, To His Woman, to understand that the woman you have found is the beginning of a journey towards a horizon that lies within the relationship with her, but is greater than that relationship and goes beyond it. Thus, the woman is the symbol of a higher ideal of goodness, of beauty, and of love. This broader horizon must preside over all man's activities, otherwise that activity is constricted as a use of reality, and therefore as a gift to society for everyone's benefit. It seems abstract to speak of reality as a whole, but anyone who has not perceived the love with which this word reaches him, and the concreteness in which it can and must be expressed, is far away from that reality he thinks he is master of. For example, a man could tell his children, "Look at me. Look how I work." But if his children have come across a group of friends who have woken them up through a proper education, they answer him, or think to themselves if they can't quite tell him outright, "Okay, Dad, but you can't be otherwise, because you've been brought up that way. You've taught yourself that way. But things are different now. They need a new approach. Something new is needed." To educate means to keep alive this search for something new, because the horizon that moves man, in all that he does, is the infinite. In his actions, man opens himself up to a horizon that is within what he identifies as his aim. But he transcends it. He goes beyond it. Thus, everything is outstripped by the relationship that constitutes man's heart, the relationship with the infinite. An action, any action whatsoever, St. Paul says, eating or drinking, the most everyday example he could have used. Waking, how complicated. And sleeping, how simple, so near to nothingness. Living or dying is for the human glory of Christ. Man is related to the eternal mystery of the Trinity, which we know through the humanity of Christ. It is the relationship with Christ's humanity that allows us to keep our eyes and our hearts open to the real aim for which our father and mother conceived us, for which our mother gave birth to us, to live the relationship with the infinite. This is why Dante said, "Everyone confusedly perceives a good in which his soul may rest, and he desires it, and everyone strives to attain it." In his life, man strives to verify all the implications of the infinite, in terms of the fullness that this presence suggests to his heart. Educating in freedom. You cannot educate someone unless you appeal to his freedom by calling it to action and responsibility. Freedom defines the self. It is already all there when man says, I. It is all there in this I he pronounces. But freedom is also something in which one has to be educated. Usually one thinks, bitterly and sadly, of freedom as the absence of bonds. It is a temptation that has faced men of all times. When the apostles heard Jesus affirm that marriage was indissoluble, they said, if that's the case, then it's better not to marry. If freedom is the absence of bonds, then it means, for example, that my relationship with my wife is at the mercy of my whims, and vice versa. Or we think of freedom as doing just what we like. Existentially, however, we verify that it is not. How we get alarmed when our children, even when they are still young, want to travel their own road, want to use their time as they like, want to choose according to their interests. This is the aspect that St. Augustine grasped when he observed that man always follows the delectatio vitrix, the victorious attraction, the strongest attraction. For the predominant mentality, following this attraction usually means following one's instinct, because normally what is strongest is instinct, reaction. This is always the choice that the intelligence makes, to suit one's own convenience or interests. So is freedom simply to do what you like? No, this is not freedom. Experientially, even psychologically, man feels free, truly free, not when he is doing what he likes, but when he is satisfied, when something satisfies him. Satis facit, completes or fulfills him. But what can complete or fulfill man? Quid animo satis, St. Francis of Assisi asked. What can be enough for the soul? Only relationship with the infinite. Freedom is not what justifies man's actions within the terms with which he measures reality. When man makes himself the measure of all things, then it is as if what he cannot measure does not exist. Freedom is not the employment of a measure that confines reality within four walls, whether they be as small as those of a room or as huge as those of the universe, because the universe is still a room, Leopardi's earthly room. Just as you can suffocate in a tiny room, if you are ill in bed for days and days, you can suffocate while looking at the sky, the earth, and the sea, if you look at them as limited. Death is the symbol of all this, the supreme limit. Freedom is not the activity that man carries out while making himself the measure of things, or a space in which he can be master. Freedom is adherence to reality that never stops being investigated, which the eye never ceases to penetrate, even were we to live 1,000 years. In fact, after 1,000 years, we would be even more pervaded by the sense of awe that comes as we think of our limitation before the immensity of the origin of things, of the incommensurability of the mystery, of things, and of the universe as mystery. Freedom is that level of nature, in which nature becomes capable of relationship with the infinite, in which nature says you to this ineffable, incomprehensible, unimaginable presence without which nothing is conceivable, because nothing makes itself. There is no evidence more imposing than this. In this instant, the most evident thing to me, according to my maturity, more evident than the fact that I am, that I exist, is that I am not making myself. The most vivid aspect of the perception of my existence is that I don't make myself. I don't give myself even a single hair of my head, as Jesus said. True freedom is therefore the capacity that man has to adhere to being, not only to decide, but to approve of being and adhere to it. Thus, the relationship between the self and all that surrounds it, between the self and the universe, comes to be conceived as a marriage, a profound union. It is a universal spousal image. Now, precisely this freedom, all intent on embracing reality more and more, becomes a factor of recovery when your knowledge of things, and therefore your approach to what you have in hand, is blocked within the narrowness of your own measure. When, in other words, you act without the sense of that beyond that lies within and behind all that man takes hold of. For freedom makes us more attentive to every reminder and every correction, in the etymological sense we have stressed, sustaining each other. The more you love perfection and the reality of things, the more you love the persons for whom you do things, and the more you love the society for which you work, whatever kind of work you do, then the more you want to be perfected by correction. This is the poverty in possessing things that makes man an actor, a creator, and a protagonist. As well as being a factor of continual recovery, freedom is also a creative impulse. If it is a relationship with the infinite, it draws from the infinite an unfailing will to create. Just as everything can be corrected, so everything can be created in obedience to God. This creator instinct is what qualifies freedom in a more positive and experientially appealing way. A society is made by the assertion of this creativity, of which man's freedom is capable. We can now point out the factors of a true adult education and of human freedom affirmed seriously. An education and a freedom conceived according to their profound original meaning. Educating in social life. Education in perfect freedom expresses also itself as education in social life. This gives room to approximation because of the risk present in every contingent moment. Education in social life implies four basic points. Education in labor and works, freedom of education in justice, and education in political life. A. Labor and works. Christian companionship educates us to enter into the whole of reality through the manipulation of reality itself. Through work, the work of housewives and mothers with their children, the work of big managers, or of those who have even more substantial power. It is above all in the approach to day-to-day circumstances, implicit in his work, that man goes more deeply into the original dynamic that, in continuous impact with reality, brings out the needs that make up his self, the need for good, for truth, and for beauty. This dynamic, as a continuous discovery, is a true work within work, or, more precisely, the true work of life. In work, man strives to project himself, his plan, and his ideal into time and space. For Christianity, human work is the slow beginning of man's dominion over things, a lordship to which he aspires by realizing the image of God, the Lord. Precisely through work, reality is transformed and shaped by man. After original sin, reality is no longer directly ordered to its end, as it was in the beginning. It has become ambiguous. How can it come to be shaped once more according to truth? Where do we start? We start from the human friendship that is established among those who gather together in the name of Christ, and is called the Church. For it was the Christ event that gave back to the world its true meaning. Christians collaborate in this way, in the Father's plan for the world. The Christian community, with the active grace of the Spirit, collaborates in the plan of redemption through work. In this way, work becomes an expansion of the mystery of salvation in every moment and activity, in the context of each one's personal function and situation. Sincere respect for work makes it intolerable that others cannot work. Because education in freedom is abstract if a man has no work to learn or to do. It is in carrying out my work that I understand that I am free, that my freedom is respected, or on the contrary, that everything is hindered, restricted, inadequately defined, or predefined. Education in freedom is impossible without the opportunity to have a job. An unemployed person suffers a serious attack on his self-awareness. Man does not know himself by reflecting on himself. This requires an objectivity of which few are capable, possible through a proper philosophical preparation. But he perceives his value, his faculties, his capabilities, by doing, by working, in actu exercito, as St. Thomas Aquinas says. A man gets to know himself only in action, in the course of action, while he is in action. So, if he has no work in life, man has less knowledge of himself. He tends to lose the sense of his life. We said that freedom is not simply being able to choose, but the need and the desire for the infinite, a striving towards the infinite. This infinite destiny we are made for is realized through day-to-day needs, in which your own need for the infinite is articulated and becomes concrete. Daily needs provoke us to move towards destiny. Thus, the need for a particular thing is the way that infinity touches us and makes us react. This reaction, if it comes from a self that is engaged and not bent just on comfort, will lead us to deal with the need naturally, in some sort of systematic way. This can lead to an enterprise. An enterprise appears as the concretization in a given moment, therefore eminently open to criticism and refinement of an ideal that cannot fail to be acknowledged as greater than any solution conceived and realized. The origin of an enterprise is the attempt to give a systematic answer, in terms of the image suggested by the ideal, to a need that you meet at a particular time, on a particular day. But, just as we cannot be born and cannot live on our own, so we cannot find answers to our own needs, whatever they may be, even the most personal ones, unless we are in a companionship, with the help of a companionship. No one can tackle a need as systematically as our natural life requires if he is alone. The action that creates an enterprise is, by its very nature, intent on answering the need of the person. And in that sense, it is also intent on efficiency, combating everything that could compromise it. The work for an enterprise aimed at answering the need of an individual is characterized by this ultimate sociality of our presence in the world, and, therefore, by the need for companionship. This is a great thing. So we are more and more deeply attached to the figure of God, who became one of us and has become present for all times, precisely within a companionship. I shall be with you all days, till the end of time. The human factors of the question, striving towards destiny, commitment to the needs and the companionship necessary, are exalted by our admiration, by the memory, that is to say, by the recognition of Christ present. Work is thus the final synthesis of the relationship between the I and the reality that provokes it, projecting it towards destiny, in other words, towards Christ, and is also the synthesis between this provocation by reality and the relationship with all those who acknowledge the Lord, our destiny, which has become a presence. What characterizes enterprises generated by an authentic responsibility must be realism and prudence. Realism is tied up with the fact that truth is the conforming of the intellect to reality, while prudence, which in the Summa of St. Thomas is defined as a correct criterion in the things we do, is the measure of the truth of things, before being a measure of the ethical aspect of goodness. Precisely because of this need for realism and prudence, an enterprise becomes the sign of a capacity for imagination, for sacrifice, and for openness. In this free and creative social experience are rooted the strength and the durability of personal responsibility, even in the face of power. Personal responsibility is safeguarded and affirmed in the acknowledged primacy of society vis-à-vis the state. By this primacy, we mean giving value to the original fabric created by dynamic relationships between the natural communities and between the various movements present in society. By creating enterprises and aggregations, the overall movement of persons gives rise to intermediate communities, which express the freedom of the individuals empowered by associative forms. B. Freedom of education. Freedom has its most privileged expression in its ability to educate. The first implication of the words freedom of education stresses its value as an indispensable condition for full human expressivity. This is why John Paul II said, "Without freedom, there can be no culture, no authentic cultural development." Second, it indicates the intrinsic dynamic of the educative process. This is why we speak of the risk of education, because the educational process is a risk, precisely because it brings into play the freedom of both the educator and the one being educated. If this freedom is inherent to education, then we can understand how the essential condition for dignity in educational development, and in a culture, lies in your ability to value your own cultural position, and to freely communicate it to others. If one is to educate in freedom, there must be freedom in education. Concern for education is surely the greatest sign of the will to give and of loving passion for man. In concrete life, the first freedom is not, so to say, towards myself, but towards the one I love, my child, my brother, and, from a Christian standpoint, even towards a complete stranger. As regards someone you love, how desirable is this freedom to educate, in educating, in helping a person to enter into the whole of reality? In a mature man, this desire is almost stronger than a mother's love for her child. To transform the world, we must bring our humanity to fulfillment in all its dimensions. But a true humanity cannot develop in a regime of constrictions. Today there is much talk of pluralism in education, but in practice it is not tolerated. So much so that Pope Paul VI went as far as to speak of cultural terrorism to point out how serious had become the situation in which the whole process of education and culture is enslaved by power. Without freedom, there can be neither true human education nor authentic culture. So education and culture, which are born free, must spread in a regime of freedom. C. Justice. In a free society, true justice is the source of peace, which is the sign of true belonging to God. But our justice is not enough. This kind of abuse of the idea of justice and the practical distortion of it show how far human action can deviate from justice itself, even when it is being undertaken in the name of justice. Not in vain did Christ challenge his listeners, faithful to the doctrine of the Old Testament, for their attitude which was manifested in the words, "An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth." This was the form of distortion of justice at that time, and today's forms continue to be modeled on it. It is obvious that in the name of an alleged justice, for example, historical justice or class justice, the neighbor is sometimes destroyed, killed, deprived of liberty, or stripped of fundamental human rights. For there to be peace in social life, it is necessary that justice be seriously and honestly practiced, respecting first of all those rights of the individual, of the person, that have characterized the history of jurisprudence in civil society. There is civil society when jurisprudence respects these original and irreducible needs that cannot be sacrificed by any norm or by any power. Justice cannot be affirmed by treading on the values with which the life of a people is woven, destroying its welfare and the possibility of a view to the future, leading astray the most attentive hearts. It was exactly this historical experience that led to the affirmation, "Summum jus, summum injuria." This affirmation does not underestimate human effort, and does not weaken the meaning of the order that man tries to establish, as an answer to the natural needs for justice present in his heart. On the one hand, it contests the abstract and therefore violent claim of an absolute measure of justice, one disengaged from the consideration of the totality of the factors that constitute the good of the person and the common good. And on the other hand, it indicates the need for a reference that is not exhausted within the bounds of human measure, but draws from the power of Christ, who is the true answer and ideal image of the human need for justice. Moreover, this becomes glaringly evident with the realistic realization, continually suggested by life experience, that in order for there to be true justice, human goodwill and consistency are not enough. Who is able to be consistent? No one. For perfection is not the result of a consistency. Even for justice, perfection comes from the relationship with destiny made man, with a you, living and present in the complexity of human existence. So St. Paul says, with great realism and foresight, "Now it is evident that no man is justified before God by the law. For he who through faith is righteous shall live." D. Political life. In his relentless effort to know and embrace the real, so as to make it more in keeping with the ideal impetus that moves him, man has to deal with power. By power, we mean what Romano Guardini, in one of his books, indicates as the factor defining the common goal and the organization of things needed for achieving it. Now, either power is determined by the will of serving God's creature, as it evolves, that is to say, to serve man, culture, and the consequent praxis, or it tends to reduce human reality to what it has previously decided as its own image of the evolution of reality and of history. As a rule, in this second case, power is identified with a state that posits itself as the source of all rights and thus tends to reduce man, as Gaudium et Spes tells us, to a speck of matter or an anonymous citizen of the earthly city. If power aims exclusively at achieving its own image of the real, it must seek to govern human desires, for desire is the emblem of freedom, because it expresses man's original openness to the horizon of totality. The problem of power is that of securing for itself the maximum consensus from a mass of people that is more and more conditioned as regards its needs. Thus, the mass media, the main vehicle of secularized culture, become tools for the tenacious inculcation of certain desires and for the obliteration or exclusion of others. Man's desires, and therefore his values, undergo an essential and systematic reduction, as John Paul II observed in the encyclical Dives in Misericordia. This is the tragedy of our time, the loss of freedom of conscience on the part of whole peoples achieved by the cynical use of mass media by those in power. What then is the consequence of all this? The social panorama becomes more and more uniform and gray. It is the great homogenization of which Pier Paolo Pasolini spoke. We could describe the situation with this formula. P mu I. Power is directly proportional to impotence. Power becomes high-handedness before an impotence brought about through the systematic reduction of desires, of needs, and of values. Václav Beloradsky, one of the first signatories of Charta 77, said in an interview, "European tradition means never being able to live beyond the bounds of one's conscience, reducing it to an anonymous apparatus, like the law or the state. This firmness of the conscience is a heritage of the Greek, Christian, bourgeois tradition. The irreducibility of conscience to institutions is under threat in the age of mass media, of totalitarian states, and of the general computerization of society. For it's all too easy for us to imagine institutions so perfectly organized as to impose anything they do as legitimate. You only need an efficient organization at your disposal to legitimize anything at all." We could summarize the essence of what is threatening us as follows. The states program the citizens. The industries program the consumers. The publishing houses program the readers, etc. Little by little, society becomes something the state produces for itself. The leveling out of desire gives rise to bewilderment in the young and cynicism in adults. Then what alternative is there to this general feebleness? Voluntarism with no breath and no horizon, without genius and with no space of freedom, a moralism of dependence on the state, conceived as the ultimate source of consistency for the human flow of history. If politics is the set of models and methods for tackling problems of human life in society, then a dramatic comparison between these models must be developed to establish who should lead the people in each moment. A political organization that would tend to suffocate, rather than favor and defend social creativity, would inevitably contribute towards generating or sustaining a state that domineers society. Such a state would be reduced to serving the plans of those in power. Personal and social responsibility would be evoked only to arouse consensus on what has already been planned. And even morality would be conceived and acclaimed to serve the status quo, which would perhaps be called peace. Pasolini bitterly suggested that a state of power, that is to say, a state as a power setup, such as we see forming in many situations today, is practically unchangeable. Such a state ends up leaving space for utopia, aware that utopia cannot stand the test of time, or to individual nostalgia, aware of its impotence to bring about any change. On the contrary, true politics is that which defends the newness of life in the present, capable of changing the power establishment. Politics must decide, therefore, whether to favor society exclusively, as an instrument of manipulation by the state, an object of its power, or to favor a state that is truly secular, that is to say, at the service of living society, according to the Thomistic concept of common good, continually and vigorously referred to by the Church's magisterium. Politics, then, must be in an ideal position. In other words, one that explicitly recognizes man's original link with his destiny. Without an ideal position, man is incapable of a certainty that can develop into building something. We have already noted that a people are formed by a means of a particular event that took place in time and are united by an ideal that they pursue, recognized and sensed to a greater or lesser degree. Otherwise, what we have is not a people, but a flock of sheep. And the greatest temptation for those in power is to make the people into a flock of sheep. That is to say, to deprive them of every ideal, while preserving all the exterior forms. O people of Italy, old slothful Titan, I called you vile to your face. You called out to me. Bravo. A political program that is interested not in an ideal position, but in success, by means of conquered power, is an enemy of the people. A political program concerned with an ideal position sets in motion an educational process, bringing about a wider aspiration of freedom for all, and therefore greater creativity and vision. These days, there are no great creators, and it's more and more difficult for them to arise, because there is little space for creativity. Politics needs to be practiced by people who have a real interest in man. This is a duty that binds us in our choice of who should represent us. It is an essential premise. Then they can speak of economy, railways, armed forces, and secret services. But first, they must show they have a real interest in man. This is what makes politics an activity that collaborates with the plan of God, the Lord. In other words, the only political schema whose power is irresistible positivity. The characteristic of the new people born of the event of Christ, in approaching day-to-day circumstances, in the efforts, the risks, and sacrifices this implies, is a free giving that tries to imitate the superabundance and the grace with which Christ came and has remained among us. A free giving that is a source of gladness amidst sacrifices, contradictions, and pain. A passage of the Ambrosian Liturgy says, Notam faciam gloriam nominis mei, in laetitia cordis eorum. I will make known my presence through the gladness of their hearts. And another states explicitly the link between this gladness and the event of a new people. In simplicitate cordis mei, leatus obtuli universa, et sic in genti gaudio, populum tuum vidi tibi offere donaria. In the simplicity of my heart, I was glad to offer you everything, and thus I saw your people offer you gifts with great joy. It is the echo of Jesus' last recommendation. I have told you these things, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy be complete. And Jesus was speaking of this joy just a few hours before he was murdered. The event of Christ has to do with the present. So much so that it effectively changes the present, more effectively than all the social resources imaginable. Because joy, or gladness, cannot be the aim of any social resource, however newly conceived. The supreme duty of one who has faith, of the protagonist of history in this new people, is precisely that of demonstrating, of witnessing the truth of the Christ event through a gladness that endures, even in the worst circumstances of life, since gladness is the exceptional dizzying epitome of a change that has taken place, a change that reveals a new ontology.